Blog Talk Radio.
Hey everybody, welcome to the first new episode of Radio Free Mafia. And I have the honor, first of all, stand up and face, I hope, South, maybe Southwest, and bow greatly because we have probably the best looking professional poker player, if I may, the greatest television producer of the world on today to talk about his most interesting life, his connections to poker, big-time Hollywood stars, and perhaps he'll teach us a few tricks of how to pick up those hot Hollywood actresses. And I give you the grun, the most famous of all time, Houston Curtis. Hey, go you.
Hey.
How you doing?
Hey, Wayne. How you doing, man? Thanks so much for having me on.
My pleasure, sir. But let's get to the chase. How did you get involved with cards, first of all?
You know, when I started, like a lot of kids who love cards, I started really early. And my dad was always playing cards around. You know, he'd have buddies over. And I was probably 5 or 6 when I first, you know, he kind of found me just shadowing him there like a little kid does to his dad. And I watched all night, and I was kind of watching, you know, what they were doing. And at one point he got me up on his lap, and he kind of just taught me real quick. He was starting to teach me the rules of the game, and he kind of figured out I'd already figured it out. I'd already figured out the basic hands, you know, like a pair and two pair and stuff like that. They're playing 5-card stud and 5-card draw and 7-card stud, you know, those games that we used to play at home. And at one point in the night, he ended up getting up and, you know, taking a phone call or something. And I actually played his, you know, hands, his cards for a few hands and even won a pot, and which got me really excited. And then when the game was over, he said, "Let me show you something, boy." I mean, my dad was from Louisiana and he had this deep voice. And he took the cards, and he had me pick a card, and he put the card on top of the deck, set the deck on the table, and then he smacked the deck with his hand and brought his other hand from under the table, and it was holding my card. And I just thought that was the coolest thing I'd ever seen. It was just a simple magic trick. But so in the my first real experience with cards, I learned my first magic trick, and I learned how to play poker on the same day. And I kind of fell in love with it from there. And it was a love affair that's really lasted my entire life.
Incredible. How hard was it to pick up different magic tricks with cards?
Well, you know, I started out, I became obsessed with magic for a long time. I remember in the 5th grade, I did like 2 shows for my school, and I used to go down to the mall and I would perform magic tricks for money. And that year I ordered this, do you remember, in the back of Boy's Life, they always had these cool little ads where you could order like Snappin' Pops and X-ray goggles and
stuff
like that. And it was from a company called the Johnson Smith, it was the Johnson Smith catalog. And I would get this catalog in the mail, you know, for all the youngsters out there, this is way before the internet. And they would have all these really cool items, and they'd have a lot of magic tricks. And one Christmas, I, like, ordered all my Christmas gifts from this catalog. And one of the things that I really wanted was this book. It was called The Amateur Magician's Handbook by Henry Hay. And I was reading the book, and there was a part in the book where it started talking about this move called the bottom deal, how to deal cards from the bottom of the deck. And he prefaced it by saying, "This isn't a move that's really good for magicians." Now, this book was written a long time ago, and magicians didn't really even know how to utilize a bottom deal into a magic act then. Now they do. But he went on to say that this is a gambling move, and it was originally taught in a book called Expert at the Card Table that was written in 1902 by this guy named S.W. Erdnase.
Wow.
And so I became obsessed with finding this book. And, you know, unfortunately back then, it wasn't like it is today where you can just go on Amazon and look up a book and get it. I looked at the library. They didn't have it. I looked, you know, at the local bookstores, and it was like maybe a year and a half, 2 years later, I finally find this book in a bookstore that had a big magic section in it. It might have even been a magic shop. I can't remember now. But I was ecstatic, and I took the book home, and I found out that S.W. Yerdanes was, you know, it was a fake name. It was a guy, no one knows who this guy really was. He was a professional gambler, and he wrote what has become today and still is, I would say, the Bible of card manipulation at the card table. And so I became just immersed in this book and learned all the moves. And I decided right then and there I was never going to really do magic in front of my friends anymore. And I had this romantic notion that one day I was going to be like, you know, kind of like one of these riverboat gamblers who would go out and, you know, win all these poker games. And that's kind of what I did, you know, for many years. And we can get into that more. But, you know, that's how I got started.
That's an incredible story. Interesting, too, that you talk about books written at the turn of the two centuries ago, you know, the early 1900s, because gambling as a profession was something that was, well, not often, but was known to be around, especially in the South. Huh. Fascinating.
Yeah. And the professional, a lot of people don't realize this, but the what would be considered a professional gambler back then, in those days, was a card cheat. There were gamblers, and then there were professionals. The professionals were guys who knew how to handle a deck of cards, which is kind of shocking for a lot of the young, you know, poker players to hear, because they're, you know, they've been just, you know, preached to and convinced of that, you know, there is absolutely no cheating that happens in modern day poker, and you know, they couldn't be, you know, they couldn't be farther from the truth. And I'm not condoning it, but I'm just saying a lot of these guys need to learn a lot of these moves, which I'm now teaching on my website at cardsharp.com. That's with a K. I'm teaching a lot of these moves, not just for I'm teaching them for two reasons. One, for the art of it, which a lot of magicians, you know, from around the world study with me privately, guys who are really fascinated with sleight of hand, but also casino executives and casinos and people who are running high stakes poker games who want to learn how to protect their game from cheaters. If you really want to learn how to do that, then you need to learn what it is a guy with my kind of skill set can actually do when he gets his hands on a deck of playing cards. And until you really learn what that is, you'll always be susceptible to, you know, having your game taken down.
Which is the last thing they want, is having a professional gambler, in quotes, negative connotation, coming in and taking advantage of players who don't know what's going on and losing big time.
Right.
Because then I can come back and play anymore, and it gives the game a bad reputation.
Yeah, so if these guys can learn these moves and learn what it is that, you know, it's not, and it's not just card manipulation, but it's also team play, and there's a term called, you know, having paper down, which means they're having marked cards on the table, and, you know, they've been marking cards since cards were invented, man. You know, as soon as the deck of playing cards were invented, there was somebody figuring out how to cheat with them. And if you don't school yourself on those methods, then you know, you're looking for trouble.
Oh, absolutely! I can. To me, and I'm no professional. Trust me when I say this, right? If I was going to try to manipulate a game, I would do it with a hat, babe, and try to get the bad players to be more interested in her than what was going on at the table. But that's me.
Right.
That's a thing for women.
That's,
you know.
Look, that's a. You know what they call that in the magic world? They call that misdirection.
Right.
You know, so if you get you have a beautiful woman at the table that is taking the attention away from, you know, what's actually going on in the game, that can be a huge advantage. And you know, there's lots of different ways to take down a game that doesn't entail actual card manipulation, but it's more like human manipulation. And I find it funny that a lot of guys, you know, they frown on one and don't frown on the other. You know, I have a new article coming out in Card Player magazine. I'm now writing a weekly, bi-weekly column for Card Player. And I tell a story in this issue that I just turned in today. I'll give you the scoop on it. A true story that happened to me when I was younger, in the 90s. I was working for a production company, and there was a guy who was throwing this poker game, and he knew that – he didn't know the extent to what I could do with a deck of cards, but he knew that I played cards. So he invited me. I was just a production assistant, and as far as he knew, I didn't have the money to sit in the game. The truth is, I could have, because I was also playing, you know, side games at night. But he asked me to deal. He said he'd give me $50. So I said, yeah. And what he did, he would invite all these underlings from the office and kind of bully them into playing with him. And they were really playing, you know, beyond their bankroll, but they didn't want to say no to the guy, because this is a guy who could give him promotions. He could put him on projects, so on and so forth. And he was manipulating them. And then what he would do is, they were all green. And do you know, are you familiar with a prop bet? It's a flop bet where if you're playing Texas Hold'em, you could say, okay, I'm going to take three cards. I'll take two, five, and seven. And if a two, five, or seven hits the flop, you give me $100. If it doesn't hit the flop, I'll give you $100. Are you familiar with that bet?
No, sir.
Okay, well, a lot of people aren't. But what it is, it's a sucker's bet, because it seems like, oh, there's three cards out of 52. Hey, this guy, why would he do that? I got a great shot. Well, it's not really the case. If you really run the math, you know, because you have three cards, and then you have three chances to hit those cards, because there's three cards on the flop. People don't think about that. So, you know, that's three times three, you know, times the amount of cards in the deck, and there's four of each card. So you actually end up having more of a shot to hit this card than you don't. So more often than not, you're going to win the bet. Not 100% of the time, but definitely it's much better than a 50%, you know, edge.
Sure.
So he would run this scam on these guys, and he did it over and over. And I dealt for him a couple of weeks. And a buddy of mine who worked, he was like a tape vault manager, he came to the game. And I knew this guy did not have any dough. Like, he was playing way beyond his means, and he couldn't hold on to his money. He was a really good guy. And so he started doing this bet with this guy, and he was burying him all night. And then the game ends, and the guy, I mean, it was a decent-sized game for, you know, back then, especially considering the guys he was playing with were making less than 100 grand a year, and he was making like 200 grand a year. You know, they were winning like, you know, 5 grand a night was the big winner, which was him. And he was winning all this money on the side bet. So the game's over, and everyone's having drinks and stuff, and I pull my buddy aside, and I started, I gave him a real quick I said, just go with me on this. And I start showing him this little game. And I cut the deck into four piles, face up, where you could see one card. And then I would turn that card over face down. And then he would have to name the cards. And if he could name all four, he would win. And sure enough, this guy, Benji, who was running the game, came up. He said, what are you guys doing? I said, oh, we're playing a little game. And I showed him. And the guy, you know, he named three out of the four cards. He got the fourth one wrong. And Benji immediately goes, oh, you're an idiot. No wonder you lost so much money. I could tell you what that card is. And so Benji said, oh, you think you can't? Well, I'll bet you everything you won tonight that you can't name all four of these cards twice, two times in a row. And he said, no, I don't want to do it two times in a row, but I'll do it once for all the money tonight. And then I piped in and I said, yeah, but if you get more than one card wrong, you got to give him at least an extra $1,000. He's like, fine, let's do it. And I just hustled him, because there was no way this guy was going to be able to name these cards.
Right.
And I can tell you that because all four of those cards weren't going to be exactly the same as he would see me take the card off the deck and turn it face down, take another one off the deck, turn it face down, take another one, turn it face down, take another. Then he'd name them all, but he was never, ever going to get all four of them right. And in this case, he missed the very first one, lost the whole night's, wage. And then I said, well, wait a minute, you got to name the rest because you're going to owe him another $1,000 if you miss another one. He got the second one right, got the third one right, and then, of course, missed the fourth one. And, I bring it up because it may not be ethical to use deception with a deck of playing cards, but it was, I don't think it was any less ethical to do that than to do what he was doing, which was, bullying guys to play beyond their means and to, and then to take bets that, had a sucker's edge because they were novices and didn't know, So
he was really taking advantage of people he shouldn't have been.
Right. Yeah. So I kind of pulled a Robin Hood move, in my opinion. And that's the way I kind of treated a lot of the games that I played in where there was, major manipulation going on. I mean, that's when I was playing with some guys who were, mobbed up scumbags, and I didn't mind taking them down. But in my book, The $1 Billion Hollywood Heist, I share a lot of these stories. But once I got to the big game with Tobey Maguire and Leo DiCaprio and Ben Affleck and all these dudes, there was no need for card manipulation because the game was a perfect scenario. The guys that we were beating were never going to get hurt because they had too much money to get hurt. They just enjoyed playing with celebrities. They wanted to have a good time. They could never lose enough money for it to matter to them, but it would certainly matter to me. It changed my life,
No
one was getting hurt.
No. In my opinion, it seems like to me that Joe Blow was playing these card games, knowing he most likely was going to lose, but he would be losing to people that he liked. He was paying a cost to be around them.
Yeah, and when we first started, the hustle of the game at the beginning, right in around 2004, 2005, No Limit Hold'em was exploding on television. And a lot of guys, weren't playing poker prior to that explosion. And you got a lot of guys who had never even held a deck of cards in their hands, never played in a home, didn't have a family rummy game they grew up playing in or nothing, who all of a sudden thought, oh, I can play poker because all I got to do is have this dealer deal me two cards. I look at the cards and I match it on the board and, how hard could it be? So you get a lot of guys coming out of the woodwork to play, and then you say, and you're going to get to play with Leonardo DiCaprio and Tobey Maguire. Well, and you tell them the buy-in's $5,000. Now, that's what it was when we first started. And these were rich guys. They're like, I'd pay $5,000 just to hang out with Leo for a night. But what they didn't know is the blinds were 100, 200. So the minimum coming bet was $200, and it was no limit. So to play in a 100, 200 blind game, you really need about 50,000 to sit right in a game like that. But these guys didn't understand the relation of the blinds to the bankroll. And they would go bust, in one orbit by the time the button came around and reload. So in an hour and a half, you'd get guys who thought they were coming in to play with $5,000 and they'd be in $35,000. And that's how the game started. And it was a nice little, cherry patch for a long time. And that was when we first moved it out of Toby's kitchen, because it really started in Toby's kitchen. And then we went to the Viper Room, and that's where we met Molly Bloom.
Now, if I was involved in one of these games, I was invited, I could hang out with big-time celebrities like yourself, and I knew it'd be costing money, I would use that opportunity. I would not care about winning a hand. What I would want is a social interaction so I could hopefully call them up the next day, next week, and say, hey, my name is Wayne Klingman. I got a movie idea, or I have a book idea, or I got a stock investment that you might be interested in. Did anybody look at the games like that?
Were they thinking they were going to be... there were lots of business deals that went on in the game, but I think it was pretty organic. And there were guys who didn't like to talk about business at the poker table. Because, you know, as you know, when you're playing poker, it almost kind of get everything else out of your head, and, you know, all the problems in life become the problems that you're having right there at the poker table. You know,
sure.
You can allocate poker to life in a lot of ways. So it's an escape for a lot of guys. But yeah, there were, look, there were deals that went down. I did, Rick Solomon, who, he ended up being the guy that when I had the worst night of my life and I lost $1 million, Rick was the guy on the receiving end. But Rick and I did business together. We sent a crew over to Thailand. We were doing this extreme Thai prison fight documentary. There would be real estate deals guys did together. We got stock tips that we invested in. All kinds of stuff would happen like that. You know, it's bound to happen when you get a bunch of powerful men in a room.
Yeah.
And, it was inevitable.
Absolutely. I mean, that's what I would be there for. That's what I want to be part of. It cost me money to play, so be it. None of that, I'd have a tape recorder with me, so I could tape the conversations and play them back in my leisure and maybe catch that conversation about a stack tip I didn't get the first time. That's me.
Yeah, and who knows, that could have very well happened. You know, one thing I'm kind of sad about looking back is I wish we would have taken just more pictures of all of us hanging out. You know, we got there and it was good times, but you know, by the time we got to the Four Seasons, there was like $3 million on the table every night, and it was getting pretty damn serious. You know, and guys were winning, losing $500,000 a night on any given night, and it was like a damn blood sport, you know, for a while.
That's a lot of money.
It was a lot of money.
I mean, I can't imagine that. I mean, to me, I would have to be even think about playing for a few thousand, I'd have to be damn 100% sober and whole nine yards. I just can't imagine playing for a lot of money.
Well, I got to tell you, speaking of sober and playing for a lot of money, the first night that I ever lost a six-figure pot, we were at the Viper Room, and there was a guy who strolled in. He was a buddy of mine. I was actually doing some business with him, and he had a lot of money, and he'd been out partying. He wanted to play, and I got in a hand with him, and I pick up pocket fives, and I see a flop, and the flop comes 5-6-6, so I flop a boat. Four house. And he bet, I raised, he called, the turn comes a 10, and he moves all in, and I'm like, well, this is it, I got him, because I knew he didn't have it. And I called, and I turned over the full house, and he wouldn't show his cards. He's like, you got it. He's like, roll the river. And they brought out the river, and the river hit another 10. And I thought, oh, shit, I hope he didn't hit a 10 on the turn and back into a bigger full house. And he's like, nah, you got me. He was drunk, and he started to throw his cards into the muck. And then one of them bounced up and turned over, and it was a 10. He didn't even know he had the winner.
Oh, wow.
So bounced up, turned over, he had the 10. So I had to give him the money. I almost puked on the table because I'd never lost six figures in my life. So at the end of the night, and he also nailed another buddy of mine that night, who was a big director. He's directed like those Mighty Ducks movies and some other stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
This guy, Steve Brill. And Steve's like, hey, do you think you could get him to come up to my house and let's continue playing? So I said, yeah, I'm sure I could. So we after the game, we went up to Steve's house in Hollywood Hills. We played till about, I don't know, sun up. By the time the sun was up, our buddy who had beat us at the Viper Room, his name is Casey, he was like puking in Burl's toilet. we won all the money back. And
yeah.
Casey showed up with a smile on his face later that afternoon with all the dough in a trash bag, handed it to us and said, fun playing with you guys.
I says, well, and I'm going to assume, should I assume that games like this still go on in Hollywood today?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think there's a game that goes on that was as big as what we were playing, not on a regular basis. Now, there are, you know, games that happen on occasion. Our game basically started in, you know, Toby's Kitchen, graduated to the Vipe Room, and graduated to five-star hotels. And then eventually we took the game to a billionaire's home named Alec Gores. And that's when Molly went to New York to run a game, and we set her up in that game in New York. I don't know how much you know about Molly's story, but in her movie, she claims she was fired. And the truth is, I was there the night Toby personally set her up with the New York game. And which is one of the reasons I wrote this book. You know, she came out like blasting everybody who made her rich, and I just never understood it. So I kind of wanted to tell the truth.
Yeah, I think it's...
But those games were going like twice, two nights a week. And then when the market crashed in 2008, and then when Molly gave everybody's name up to the feds after we found out there was a guy in our game who had been running a Ponzi scheme and he was paying off his poker debts with stolen money, the game just kind of disbanded and my life like fell apart. I mean, my life just blew to smithereens because the market had crashed. I had a $3 million house that overnight was worth $1.1 million. And, you know, I had to pull my kids out of private school, wife and kids, like, move away and go back to the East Coast. I'm here trying to manage, you know, all this, keep the house. And then this thing with Brad Ruderman happens in the Ponzi scheme, and I had to they put another $750,000 lien on my house because that's the amount of money I took from them in the game. And Molly gave them all those numbers. And, you know, so a lot of guys took stuff personally, you know, especially me.
I take some of that stuff personally, too. I'm surprised something, thank God, nothing bad happened, you know, like a car
blew
up.
My heart about blew up. I mean, the stress was so much on me
that
I ended up at Cedars-Sinai Hospital and went into cardiac arrest and died on the table.
Ooh.
And then when I came to, you know, they tell me basically I got 5 years to live. And I'm going to tell you, man, I went into a state of depression that I would not wish on anyone. And it really took writing this book, moving out of L.A., and writing this book to kind of get my mind right. And then by some miracle, by some act of God, after being out of L.A. for about a year, the doctor pulled me in and he's like, I don't know what happened, but it looks like we beat it. And I said, beat what? And he said, your heart. Your heart's functioning as strong as mine is right now. I said, I thought you told me this was unbeatable. He said, I don't know how to explain it, but you're good. So somebody up there was giving me one more shot, Wade. And I figure I'm going to try and take it for all it's worth.
You have to. I mean, you have to. And I wonder if whatever it's worth, I'm going to give you kudos for taking a horrible situation and trying to turn around to the best job you possibly can. And more people need to have that attitude when shit happens.
Well, you know, some people would say, you know, maybe it was karma, maybe he had it coming. I don't know. I've always felt like I've been a pretty good guy. You know, I moved to Los Angeles with nothing. I didn't have a rich uncle or, you know, anybody helping me get into the entertainment business. And so I just hustled, you know. And when I say hustled, I hustled in every way I knew how. And I think, you know, when you look back at your life, if you can say that, sure, there's things we would change. Everyone has things that would change. But I'd like to think that I've lived my life with no regrets, you know, and the bad things that happened to me, you know, something good came out of them. I learned some lesson or something. And so I'd do it all over again. And, you know, it was an amazing, incredible time. It was a ride that, you know, you only hear about in movies, you know. It's an incredible life.
It is an incredible story, and I think the book is absolutely wonderful. We all should get copies for ourselves and copies for everybody that we know. Where can we find your book at?
So it's everywhere, and when I say everywhere, don't go to a bookstore because they're all closed. But leave it to me to launch a book right when the pandemic hits and they close every bookstore in the country. But Amazon, I believe Amazon might have just sold out. It's a number one top new seller in the biography category on Amazon, which is, you know, I'm really proud of. So they still have the digital copy there. But if you go to my website, because it's on pretty much any site that sells books, but if you want to help me out, I got a little affiliate code where I'll get, you know, I don't know, probably an extra 43 cents they're giving me for every book sold. But it takes you to Barnes & Noble, which is, you know, a very reliable bookseller.
Yes.
And they still have copies available. And if you go to cardsharp.com, that's www.cardsharp.com. It's just card spelled with a K. It's right there on the main page. You can click order now. Or if you want to wait, you know, a little bit, you can go through to there's an area on my site where you can actually order an autographed copy. And when I get my next shipment from my publisher, I can autograph them and send them to you. And whoever does that, whoever orders the autographed copy, I'll email them a digital copy for free while they're waiting on it.
There you go. That's a great idea. Thank you for doing that. Now, and you also teach classes online too, right? Did I understand the webpage correctly?
I do. So, you know, I have Card Sharp also has a YouTube channel. You know, everyone should check us out on YouTube and Facebook and Twitter and, you know, all the social media channels. But I'm really working on ramping up the YouTube channel this year where I put out free tutorials. But then if you go to a site, you can actually sign up for private one-on-one consultations and lessons. And I have students all over the world who I train. You know, some of them are really big, like kind of famous magicians who are looking to do, you know, some kind of gambling routine in their act. And then casino executives and guys who run big poker games who are looking to, you know, make sure that they keep their game protected. So if you want to learn sleight of hand and you want to learn from a guy who has put more hours into doing it than probably most people will ever put into any type of education they ever get in their life, then feel free to get a hold of me and I will show you how it's done. And you can email me at stacked@cardsharp.com or just contact me on any one of my social media channels, and I'll get back to you.
Outstanding. I have to ask two questions. One, I read something online tonight before we started the show that you had issues with, let's say, loose women, either nearby the games being played or trying to infiltrate the game. What was that about?
Wait, issues with who?
Prostitution.
Oh, with prostitution?
Yeah.
You know, it comes with the territory. When you're dealing with guys who have big appetites, they want everything at their disposal, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, we had one guy who he was a record label owner, and he was also just kind of a trust fund, you know, rich kid whose father had made a fortune in Canada. And he would he'd be playing, and he'd get up every half hour, and he was throwing the party too. He was dumping a lot of money in the game. So when he got up, it's kind of like, you know, we're sitting there waiting for him to come back because he's bringing a lot of action. And he'd be gone for like 35 minutes, and then he'd play for 35 minutes, and then he'd be gone again. And finally, I said, "Where the hell are you going?" He's like, "Oh man, I got two hookers. They're in the next room." And he's like, you know, just after every bad hand I lose, I just go over there and you know, they snort cocaine off my, you know what?
Yeah, yeah. Wow.
And
wow.
You know, that was just like you tell me that like it was no big deal, and I had literally just met the guy's wife like a week before. She's a beautiful woman. So there was a lot of party and a lot of craziness going on like that. And I mean, how Rick Solomon was in the game. You know, Rick's the guy who was famous for making the One Night in Paris video. He was the guy who, you know, had sex in Paris.
Yeah. I have to ask. Do you ever meet Lindsay Lohan?
With who?
Lindsay Lohan.
Oh, Lindsay?
Yeah.
I've seen Lindsay around town. You know, I played poker with a guy who was in a lot of tabloids with her. Remember the dude who called her? His name was Brandon Davis. He was the heir to the Davis oil, you know, fortune.
Okay.
And he got coined for calling her fire crotch. It became like a big thing in the tabloids.
Yeah.
So I played poker with Brandon a few times, and me and actually Nick Cassavetes, who's the guy who directed The Notebook. We chopped Brandon up in a little quick, like, three-way freeze-out before our game even started. I felt bad. Before the game even started, Brandon was broke.
Hey, you play with
the
big
dogs. He hung out with Lindsay a lot. I've hung out with Paris Hilton and her sister Nikki.
Oh,
and, I think the first time I met Paris was at I lit her cigarette at the after party of the premiere of a movie called Alpha Dog that Nick Cassavetes.
Okay, I know Alpha Dog.
And she was real sweet, but and looking gorgeous. But I didn't pay too much attention to her because I turned and there was Eddie Van Halen, and I've been a Van Halen fan for so long.
There you go.
I ended up talking to her. I let Paris just run off to the wayside, and I spent the next like 45 minutes talking to Eddie Van Halen. And then I met Nikki. Nikki actually came to Toby's, I think it was his 30th birthday party. He just had a few friends over at the house, and I was there, and Nikki Hilton was there, and some other people. And but we had a great story in the book about one of the Olsen twins. Was it Ashley or Mary Kate, the one that had the drug problem? I always forget. I know it's in the book. But one of the Olsen twins came to the game one night, and in the game that night was Joe Francis, who was the creator of Girls Gone Wild, you know, the video series.
Okay, yes, I do.
So Joe was, you know, kind of famous for partying with the Hollywood crowd, partying with the Lindsay Lohans and the Paris Hiltons and all that. And so the Olsen girl comes down, and she was there because she had a girlfriend who was there to see her boyfriend who was playing the game. And normally we didn't let people in, but because it was too very, you know, it was beautiful women, we always made an exception. And beautiful, famous women, yeah, of course we're going to let them in.
Absolutely, yeah.
So she's sitting there, and Joe Francis says, he said, "Hey, how you doing?" And she says, he's like, "Good to see you again." And she says, "Do I know you?" And Joe says, he gets really offended by that because he has a huge ego. And he said, "Well, you sure knew me when you were snorting blow off my cock in the back of my limo."
Oh.
And there was dead silence throughout the entire room. It was so uncomfortable. And then like 5 seconds of silence goes by, and then Toby just kind of started laughing. He was like going, and he couldn't hold it. And then I started laughing. Then we all started burst out laughing. The Olsen girl storms out of the Viper room, you know, never comes back, pissed as hell. And it was just like one of those things that could only happen in Hollywood, you know. It was pretty funny. So
yeah,
that
I mean,
kind of stuff we're doing all the time.
Yeah, I can't help to think that it had to have. I mean, when I can think of powerful, rich guys, you know, with those egos going on, you got beautiful women who think they can manipulate them and do whatever that was going on, you got all that stuff going, I would have to be absolutely crazy wild. I'm absolutely surprised that that you didn't have fistfights going on.
No, you know, we kept it very civilized. I mean, you know, there was it was very hard to get to us. You know, sometimes there would be a guy with a gun at the door. Other times it'd be so secretive in the way that, you know, the game just kind of went off in the first place that nobody knew about it. And all of the valet, who you take care of when you're at the hotels, you take care of the valet guys, you know, because those are the guys who people go to when they want to find out who's at the bar, who's here, who's staying at the hotel. And every one of us took care of the, and when I pulled up to the Four Seasons, the valet guy would, every time he'd say, "Mr. Houston, welcome home, welcome home." They'd always say, "Welcome home." And they'd take my car, they'd park it right up front. And, of course, I was driving like a $200,000 Mercedes, so they probably would have parked it up front anyway. But you know, you slip a $100 bill in their hand, and, you know, once everybody in the game does that, you know, that guy makes an extra, you know, $1,000 a night just on tips. And then I usually give them $100 on my way out.
Right. And make sure they take care of you.
Yeah, you take care of them and they take care of you, you know.
Yeah, I mean, that's the way it goes. If you don't, that's how you prevent problems, is because the valets will tell you.
Well, when you're playing in a game that's that high profile, you kind of, you know, you got to take precautions.
Yeah.
And we had people, a lot of people tried to get in the game at the Viper Room. I'll tell you a funny story. One night we're playing in the Viper Room, and Toby, you know, he was a vegan. So he has a weird, you know, he eats, you know, like, I would always bust his balls about it. But he would always eat, you know, like weird non-dairy, non-meat stuff. And he forgot to bring his meal with him one night. So he called his girlfriend, Jen, who he later married, Jennifer Meyer, who's the daughter of Ron Meyer, the president of Universal. And so, you know, Jen is like, Jen hangs around with like her best friends are like Jennifer Aniston and, you know, Kate Winslet, people like that. And,
sure.
And she brings Toby's food over, and we made the game so hard to get into that the guy at the door, he didn't recognize her because she wasn't like a celebrity. She was just, you know, kind of like Hollywood royalty, but she wasn't a celebrity. So Toby gets a call all of a sudden, and she says, he shows me the text. It was a text. "I'm out here trying to deliver your food, and this asshole at the door just told me if I wanted to get into the game, I was going to have to blow him." So Toby looks and he's like, "God," and he's like, "Am I going to have to like go fight this guy now?" I'm like, "Dude, he didn't know. He doesn't know. He's just trying to have our back." So
right.
I told Darren, who owned the Viper Room, Darren jumped up immediately and ran out to take care of it. Next thing you know, 5 minutes later, Jen's walking in with the food, and then all of a sudden the door guy, the bouncer who had told her this, he shows up with a dozen red roses, gets down on his knees, says, "I want to beg your forgiveness. I was only trying to protect your boyfriend from other girls getting in here. I'm so sorry I didn't know who you were. I will never forget your face again. And by the way, just so you know, I'm gay." So it was a great little moment. It really was.
Yes, it had to be. The stories you have, not only in the book, the ones you haven't quite told people, you have to be absolutely amazing.
Oh, it's a hit. And I think what I've really been pleased at seeing is, you know, one of these guys who I knew were, you know, big Vegas insiders read it, and who had always said, you know, Molly's game, her book was, you know, a crock. And I got a lot of validation because they're reading this. They're saying, yeah, if you want to hear how this thing really went down, read this book.
Yeah.
And, you know, and then other people are just saying they can't put it down. And, you know, I feel very blessed and glad that it's doing well. And, hopefully it'll just give me the opportunity to do what I've been doing. A big part of my life is telling stories in one way or another.
I didn't know I'd ever
be telling them about my life, but
you don't know what you don't know. You don't know what thing each day can bring. You know, when you give an opportunity, you know how to hustle. We know this.
Well, you know all about telling stories. You've written some books yourself.
Well, I tried, and this show tonight is brought to my book, Thank You for Asking, is brought to you by my book, Mr. Big Talks Craft, which is available on Amazon, along with the other series of books we have on gambling table games and my book on the Milwaukee Mafia. But that's another story for another time. But I would love, if the fates allowed, to have you part of my idea. We take a bunch of really good-looking girls. Think of Ron Meyer and Russ Meyer, right? Russ Meyer type of girls, right? We teach them how to play poker. We send them down to some of these poker rooms and see what happens.
Call it the Poker Bunnies.
That's right. Mr. Big Girls, right? And I think they would do well because, one, the looks would distract the, I don't know what you want to term, people who don't have a clue, right? And then, of course, the skills would help them.
Well, you know, I think that a lot of the, you know, there's some good women pros out there who've used that angle for years. I produced all of the Annie Duke poker instructional videos, and you know, Annie told me all kinds of stories about when she was coming up playing in the back room bars and stuff when she was young. You know, guys just they weren't used to women being at a table at all, and they would get them, you know, just really distracted. They'd start making bad decisions. And as soon as someone gets distracted and starts making bad decisions, you know, that's when you can clean up, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I heard. My understanding is that one of the problems that the Chicago charity poker people have is that they want to encourage more women to show up to play. Why not, right? Because their money is good and they want to have a nice time. Why not invite them, right? But for some reason, male players like to give them a hard time, and I simply don't get that.
Well, it's an old school mentality. You know, if you read the original copy of Doyle Brunson's famous book, Power Poker, the original title, a lot of people don't know, is called How I Won $1 Million Playing Poker. But it's kind of became the Bible of modern, you know, Texas Hold'em and you know, all the basic games that are still played in the casinos. But in his original book, he wrote that he refuses to play with women. And he had all these reasons why. And it was an old school philosophy. You know, women shouldn't be at a poker table. Well, now you see Doyle every Saturday, you know, every Friday, Saturday in Bobby's room playing with Jennifer Harmon, you know, and other women pros. And he'll tell you himself, you know, he had to change. And I think guys out there, take it from Doyle, who's the godfather of poker. These women are only going to get better at this game. So, you know, don't think that just because a pretty woman sits down next to you and starts, batting her eyes that she doesn't know what she's doing with those cards because, you know, chances are she just might, and she might end up taking you for all you got.
Right. And maybe there's a little bit of ego, and if I get beat by a woman, you know, I'm less than a man. That's bullshit. To me, the more players we have, the more enjoyment we can have, and maybe you're playing for a little bit of stakes here and there, the more money you might be able to make, right?
You know, someone said to Phil Ivey once, who's, you know, one of the greatest poker players of the modern era, probably of all time. He was being interviewed by another African-American, a famous news anchor. I can't remember his name right now, but the guy said, so he's like, what's it like being an African-American in you know, a professional poker player? He's like, do you get treated different? And Phil told him, he said, there's only one color at the poker table, green.
You know,
so the poker table can actually be a great place where people can come together of all races, all creeds, all colors, all religions, and be friendly and get along and, you know, be competitive. I found that, it's actually a really good spot to bring people together. And I think women probably have had the toughest time fitting into that universe. But, you know, with the way poker's growing now, you're just seeing more and more women that are crushing the game. And I think guys are starting to wise up a little bit.
I hope so, because if I was running a poker situation, I would be damn sure encouraging as many women as I could get to show up and play and do well.
Oh, yeah, especially if you know look, the key to winning poker, if you're not, if the game isn't on the take and on the fix, if you're running a straight game, then there's one other important, the most important factor to beating a game, in my opinion, has always been one thing: game selection, knowing who your players are. You know, I never had a desire to go sit down in Bobby's room at the Bellagio and play with all the best players in the world. I've played with all of them. I am friends with them. They've all begged me to get in my game. We let a couple of them in on occasion. But when I went to play, I went to make money. So I played with a group of guys that were never going to run out of money, and they were never going to get any better at playing poker. And that is how I was so successful for so many years playing. You know, I made more money than probably 98% of, you know, any poker professional in the world playing in a private game, because the game was just, we stocked the pond with the same fish every week, and we beat them every week, and they kept coming back.
Because they wanted whatever they got out of it, whatever enjoyment, you know, whatever, cause certainly
yeah,
was the
money. They were enjoying themselves, and, you know, hell, I saw guys lose six figures and still end up tipping out the dealer and Molly, the hostess, $30,000 just to say
wow.
Thank you for inviting me.
That's the thing is, my dad, he used to own a bar, ran pool tournaments. His big thing was pool. And the thing that he always did to make people come, encourage people to come, was Sully Sacks, good-looking women behind the bar, and a jukebox for free. He made sure everybody had a nice time.
Smart.
And he had, you know, that's how he made his money. He was damn good as a bar owner. But, you know, things changed. Anyway, well, I do want to thank you for taking the opportunity to come on this show. It's been very, very educational.
Wayne, thank you for having me, and thank you for your support. It means a lot to me. I wish you the best with your show. I hope that the next time I come on, we're looking at like a million-plus audience. I know you can do it.
I know I can do it, too. The thing is, my goal, sir, is to get you in this area and have you talk in front of an audience and charge them for the privilege for it.
Hey,
you know,
any time, if we put it together, I will be there, and I will stay after and sign as many books as till my fingers are tired.
Absolutely.
Or whatever.
It only be a pencil at all. Absolutely, sir. I do,
anytime.
Again, appreciate your time. And I do thank you for your time for that. I'll let you go so I can plug my book and stuff again, because I have to. Oh, one last thing. Where can we find your book one more time?
Thank you. So go to www.cardsharp.com. That's with a K. And you can order from Barnes & Noble off the main page. Or if you go to my store site, you can get an autographed copy. You'll have to wait a little bit for it because everything's on back order because of the pandemic. But I'll send you a digital copy immediately as soon as I see the receipt from the order. So that's the best way to get it right now. Otherwise, it's on Amazon. And anyone who's read it, if you love the book, please go to Amazon and give me a five-star review.
Five-star review.
Subscribe
and like his YouTube page and comment on some of the videos. Those are all big helps. They will help his channel grow immensely. Trust me. Anything I can do for you. And that problem that we talked about earlier, the boys would talk to them. It won't be a problem much longer.
Okay, you're going to take care of it for me?
I'm going to take care of that for you. I'll find time. All right, sir?
I appreciate that, Wayne. You have a good night.
Talk to you later, sir. Yeah, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye. What a nice guy. What a wonderful guest he was. I mean, yeah, I went a little bit fanboy. I freely admit it, but that's me. I find his life story fascinating. I find his book incredibly good. I mean, it's rare that you get that. And to think that we didn't talk about what happened to him and things fell apart. That in itself is an incredible story, how you come back for something like that. He mentioned it a little bit, but not in detail as he could have. And to think that you can, anybody, that's me, that's you, that's anybody, who's down in bad times, situations going on beyond their control, can turn to themselves or turn around with a lot of luck, no doubt about that, a lot of hard work, a lot of luck. It's empowering to me. I mean, God, you know, I've seen better days. Probably you have, too. Anyway, I want to thank everybody for listening. And remember, you can get Mr. Big Talks Craps on Amazon. So you go to Amazon, you type in Mr. Big Talk Traps, or this Mr. Big, and all the books we have will be listed there. I appreciate everybody listening to the show. Tomorrow night we have Gavin Smith, Wisconsin true crime author, on, and other cool shows coming up. Thanks again. Talk to you all soon. Bye-bye.